Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer reader. I'm reading from the July-August 2025 issue of the Smithsonian Magazine. So I hope you enjoy the program. This article is titled, A Shared Fate. Scientists worldwide have tracked worrying declines in insects and the birds that feast on them. In Vermont, researchers are searching for clues that could help save them. By Madeline Bowden. Less than 2 hours after sunrise, with the shadows still blue and slanting hard in a dense growth of balsam firs and spruces, the baby bird blundered into a fine black net strung along the ridgeline of Mount Mansfield at 4,393 feet, Vermont's tallest mountain. Desiree Narango, a conservation scientist with the Vermont Center for Eco Studies, or VCE, retrieved the rescued bird and with practiced fingers spread one of its wings like a fan. From the bird's mottled and rumpled feathers, Narango could see that this slate-colored bird was a dark-eyed junco, a sparrow species found in various color combinations across North America. The bird was just a few weeks out from leaving its nest. It was too young to tell its sex, but she was less interested in the bird itself than in what it had been eating. Juncos are known as seed-eating birds. They spend their days rummaging through the undergrowth, searching for fallen seeds. At feeders, they prefer smaller grains, like millet. But seeds don't provide the protein juncos or any songbirds need to grow a new set of feathers while they molt. And the protein this baby junco needs to molt its blotchy, juvenile feathers and to grow sleek, stone-gray feathers on top and white ones below would come only from bugs. In fact, 90% of the more than 10,700 known bird species rely on insects for food during at least part of their life cycle. Even the most dedicated seed-eating songbirds must eat insects and other arthropods, that many-legged groups of creatures that includes spiders and millipedes, to produce eggs, to grow new feathers, and to feed their young. Without insects, in other words, they wouldn't survive. Ultimately, insects are disappearing at a rate of about 1-2% a year, and the decline is not limited to just one species, nor just one group of insects. The data suggests that the decline is widespread, even global. These findings have been confirmed in hundreds of rigorous, peer-reviewed studies, says David L. Wagner, a University of Connecticut entomologist and the lead scientist of a program known as the Status of Insects, which coordinates pertinent research on insect populations from around the world. The weight of the evidence is clear, Wagner says. I feel like it would stand up in a court of law. Narango, who is now one of dozens of researchers participating in the project, was a city kid from Baltimore, with her heart set on becoming a zookeeper. Her undergraduate program at the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry required a summer semester at a biological field station in the Adirondacks. She had never been camping or even to the woods. On the tree-crowded shores of a mountain lake, she was captivated by the bouncy, fluty song of an unseen bird. By the time she figured out that it came from a white-throated sparrow, her future had been mapped. Today, she investigates the relationship between the worldwide decline in insects and the worldwide decline in birds. The bird cradled in her hand up on Mount Mansfield holds some of the answers to the mystery behind these trends. Bees, butterflies, moths, flies, beetles, ants, and a few other insects pollinate 3/4 of the world's flowering plants and crops. Their pollution services are worth up to $577 billion per year worldwide. Less well known is their critical role in helping dead things disappear. Piles of leaves and rotting stumps, the rat in the street, the elephant on the savanna, the contents of your compost bin. Insects also feed on feces, cleaning up the messes of wild and domestic animals. Dung beetles provide $380 million a year in manure, recycling for the American cattle industry. All of these cleanup activities create soil for new plant growth. Insects feed many animals we eat, such as trout, salmon, and turkeys. In some places, they feed us directly. More than 2,000 species of insect are eaten by people around the world, and that's not even considering honey. Bugs also keep each other under control. Ladybugs eat the aphids in your garden. Praying mantises eat flies, moths, roaches, grasshoppers, and more. Dragonflies patrol the skies, eating flies, midges, and mosquitoes. Some wasps are clever parasites, paralyzing other insects, including some we don't like, to feed their young. Simply put, insects are vital for the survival of land-based life on this planet. Ellen Welty, a research ecologist with the Smithsonian's Great Plains Science Program, says there are two groups of people who study insects: those who look at them as pests or carriers of disease, and those who study insects' roles in natural systems. While most insect researchers look for better ways to control grasshoppers on rangelands, Welty says she studies how, for example, grasshoppers benefit grasslands by providing enough fertilizer through their frass, that is, poop, to increase the yield of next year's grasses, which outweighs the damage they do eating this year's grasses. The Status of Insects Project, led by Wagner, helps scientists like Welty fill gaps and coordinate their research. The network doesn't just focus on the glamorous insects such as butterflies, bees, and dragonflies. Jessica Ware, the curator of invertebrate zoology at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and one of the project's principal investigators, leads a research group for cockroaches and termites. These insects are a nightmare in our homes, but are part of nature's intricate workings outside them. Only 2% of cockroach species are pests, while the other 7,000 or so species are benign, Ware says. Actually, a lot of them are really pretty, says Eliza Grams, a biologist at Binghamton University and another project leader. Similarly, termites, which are a kind of cockroach, break down old trees and are vital to tropical forest health. Everywhere, Ware says, they are an important food source for birds when they swarm during mating. She has even seen birds feasting on termite swarms in New Jersey. The Insect Network project grew out of an earlier initiative by Grams, who started as a bird researcher and became an expert in large-scale data analysis, and an entomologist friend named Graham Montgomery. The researchers realized that many existing research papers tagged with insect data were actually calculations of birds' food, so they designed a system to mine public research for data about insect population levels. It was a weird series of events, and now that's everything I do, Grams says. Grams believes that repeating long-term studies from decades ago is critical for understanding why insects have declined. While some issues are known, for example, habitat loss, non-native plants, artificial light at night, climate, and pesticides, scientists need to know a lot more about the drivers and consequences of the decline to conserve insects while protecting human needs. Repeating previous bird and insect studies is what Narango is doing on top of Mount Mansfield. VCE scientists have been studying birds there since the 1990s. As the scientists weighed, measured, and banded birds on Mount Mansfield, decade after decade, they also collected feathers, placing them in envelopes for future study. These envelopes sit in boxes in a corner of VCE's lab in the village of White River Junction. Narango plans to have those feathers analyzed for the natural variations in their carbon and nitrogen isotopes, which will uncover clues about each bird's diet. For example, she will be able to tell if it ate mostly plants and their seeds, or mostly plant-eating animals, such as caterpillars, or mostly animals that eat other animals, such as spiders. To have a recent comparison, Narango's team collects feathers from 6 bird species on Mount Mansfield, including juncos. Another scientist plucked a tail feather from the rumpled young junco and snipped off half of a still-attached wing feather, dropping the samples into a small manila envelope. Narango will analyze these feathers for carbon and nitrogen isotopes, too. Going one step further, Narango also pricked a vein in the junco's wing and gathered a drop of blood in a capillary tube. After it is analyzed for isotopes, the blood sample will give her an even more recent snapshot of what the bird has been eating. That is not all the bird had to offer. As it waited its turn to have its blood collected, it sat in a brown paper bag with a piece of filter paper on the bottom. Narango checked the bag, and yes, the baby junco had pooped there while it waited, leaving a grayish smear on the paper. This bird poop was scientific gold. Run through DNA analysis, it would tell Narango everything this bird had eaten in the last few hours, right down to the species. It's a level of specificity that has only recently become available, and for scientists studying the interaction between birds and insects, it's hard to beat. As Narango and others collected data on the birds, Zoe Pickett, a VCE summer intern and undergraduate at Mount Holyoke College, tended the traps set for ground insects. Every week throughout the summer, Pickett emptied dozens of plastic cups that had been filled with a thick liquid preservative and buried in the ground up to their rims, waiting for crawling insects to stumble in. She folded the filter containing the insects and placed it first in a plastic bag, then in an empty plastic cat food jar, and finally into her yellow backpack. Pickett said the multiple layers of packaging are vital, since slugs, mollusks, not insects, end up falling into the liquid, and their smell is uniquely bad. Back in the lab, Amber Jones, a VCE technician, transferred the insect samples into a petri dish and examined them under a microscope. Carabid beetles, a type of ground beetle, were particularly interesting to the team because they were a focus of a University of Vermont researcher who gathered data on that spot 30 years ago. That researcher wrote a report just on Mount Mansfield's Carabid beetles, and Narango's team is identifying each species to compare results. They all look small and black, Narango said, but under the microscope, you can see the fine differences between them. Jones sorted the creatures in the petri dish with a tweezer, playing a spider into one crimped-edged aluminum dish, the springtails into another, and the mites, which lived up to their name, in a third. The dishes were labeled, dried in an oven for 140 degrees Fahrenheit for 24 hours, then weighed. The results gave the researchers a picture of which insects were available for a ground-feeding bird like the baby junco to eat the week the samples were collected. The night before the baby junco landed in the research team's net, a strange, shifting light filtered through the forest, not far from where the Long Trail, Vermont's end-to-end hiking route, traverses the Mount Mansfield ridgeline. I sometimes wonder if hikers going by think aliens have landed, Narango said. A closer inspection would not have dispelled their suspicions. The source of the light, which shifted from blue to green to a white, whose secret ingredient is ultraviolet, set in the middle of what could have been an alien lantern, with the otherworldly light bulb supported in a mystifying structure of translucent plastic. It was a moth trap, with a funnel below the light to catch the moths drawn in from the surrounding forest. Narango had furnished the 5-gallon hardware store bucket that sat below the filter with a jumble of comfy cut-up egg cartons. The moths could rest among them before a jar of ammonium carbonate, also known as smelling salts or baker's ammonia, hidden at the bottom of the bucket, killed them. We are looking for non-lethal methods, but some species of moths you have to kill to identify, Narango said. And that's what they were doing in the past, so we stuck with that. When she collected the bucket the next morning and searched through the egg cartons, she didn't find much. One spectacularly patterned geometrid moth, better known for its inchworm caterpillars, and three micro leaf roller moths. There was a caddis fly in the bucket, which is a type of aquatic insect, and a few tiny flies. The hall let Narango know which caterpillars are available for birds on the mountain, as each of these moths was a caterpillar once. She doesn't survey for butterflies because birds don't eat them or their caterpillars often. Butterflies are colorful because they are typically toxic or at least taste bad to birds, she explains. Not even their caterpillars make good baby bird food. With their flashy colors, she says, butterflies are just trying too hard. Narango emphasizes that the poor catch is not an example of insect decline, but a result of a particularly chilly summer night. This is what makes insect research so tricky. If Narango only sampled moths on this chilly night in early August, she would get a different idea than if she only sampled them on the warm night at the end of May, when moths were so plentiful on Mount Mansfield that they covered both the inside and the outside of the bucket. This is why she sets the light trap every week of the field season. Though Narango and her colleagues don't yet have a final count of moths and ground insects or their species, she noticed that they were collecting many fewer moths than the research team had 30 years ago. They collected their moths in a garbage can, Narango said. She was using a mere 5-gallon bucket. On the other hand, her team was collecting more carabid ground beetles than were present 30 years ago, and more of the beetles they collected were high elevation specialists. This may be a climate refugia, Narango said, referring to a place that remains relatively unchanged during major shifts in climate. The top of Mount Mansfield has been spared from the development happening in the world below over the past 30 years. Narango has an idea of what's ahead for the baby junco and the other birds on the mountain. She previously studied birds in cities, and she found that in places with fewer native plants, there were fewer protein and fat-rich caterpillars. So the chickadees she studied turned to eating spiders, which are lower in fat instead. In these places, the chickadees laid fewer eggs, and fewer hatchlings survived to leave the nest. Graham's research shows that the quantity of insects available to birds matters. When there are more insects in a habitat, she says, birds raise fatter, happier chicks. Chris Elchick of the University of Connecticut, who now helps lead the Status of Insects Network, says if you're a swallow, maybe some insects are more like eating steak and 2 veg, and others are like eating lettuce all the time. Even knowing the strong evidence of global insect decline, neither Grams nor Narego despairs over the fate of birds and insects. They are optimistic that while they wait for policy changes, simple everyday actions can make a difference. They advise using fewer outside lights, which attract insects, distracting them sometimes to the point of death from starvation or exhaustion, and making them vulnerable to predators like spiders. It helps when lights are motion-activated and yellow or another warm color, since insects are attracted to bright white light. They also recommend using fewer insecticides. Narango knows from her own research that planting native plants in a yard or even in a pot on an apartment balcony can help provide high-protein insect food for birds. Planting a single tree can make a difference, with an oak supporting up to 557 species of caterpillars. People may not be motivated to save the insects for their own sake, but a world without insects is a world without birds. It's a world where no college student will hear the fluty song of a white-throated sparrow across a mountain lake and have her life changed. It's a world where nature offers no song to the rising sun. It's a silent spring. In the long term, it would become something even worse. Without insects, everything dies. All mammals, all reptiles, all birds, and even humans, Ware says. If you want to conserve any of those other things, including us, you should want to conserve insects. What Narango did, after making sure the junco's needle prick had healed, looked like a magic trick. But it came merely from years of experience. She fluttered her hands, a set of maneuvers to give the bird a firm launching pad. And suddenly, the junco was free. It flew into the blue shadows of a patch of balsam firs near the top of Mount Mansfield. It was time to find breakfast. That's the end of the article today. The title of the article was A Shared Fate. It was written by Madeline Bowden. Ms. Bowden is a Vermont-based environmental writer. Her last Smithsonian feature was about fireflies. I don't have time for another article, so I'll end the broadcast with a question and answer. The question is, I have an ancestor who was in Massachusetts in 1640. What is the best way to research ships that arrived before that time? The answer is, British ships of the colonial era made lists of their passengers, crew, and cargo, although not all such records are still available today. As the first passenger ship to make landfall in New England in 1620, the Mayflower was of particular historical interest, so historians have spent a lot of time researching its 102 passengers. Some left behind written records of their journey in letters and journal entries. Many, many Americans can trace their ancestry to the Mayflower, myself included. My grandmother was a member of the General Society of Mayflower Descendants, also known as the Mayflower Society, which has 100,000 members. There are many other Mayflower descendants who either didn't know their ancestry or never followed up to claim membership. For those looking to find out about New England ancestors who came over on other ships during this period, the best source of information is the New England Historic Genealogical Society, a.k.a. American Ancestors, in Boston. Its website offers a special guide for people tracing 17th century migration to New England. And that answer comes from Paul Johnston, Curator of Maritime History, National Museum of American History. And that completes the broadcast today. You've been listening to the Smithsonian Magazine program, brought to you by Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Chuck Berry. It's been my privilege to be your volunteer reader. I hope you enjoyed the program today. Stay well, stay safe, have a wonderful week. Keep listening to the premium programming offered by Sun Sounds of Arizona. Thank you so much for spending your time with me today.